Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to Democracy-ish. I'm Danielle Moody.
I'm Jad Lee.
And we are very excited to welcome to Democracy-ish Adrian Walker, who is a columnist and associate editor at the Boston Globe, whose story, A Murder in Boston, goes back to 1989 into the present day. I'll just say before Waj gives his opening, wow. Like, what a extraordinarily heartbreaking, excruciating story, Adrian. So thank you so much for joining us to talk about it today. And I'll turn it to you, Waj.
I just take this opportunity to be immature and do my movie phone voice, and Danielle indulges me.
I do.
So just give me 20 seconds. Adrian Walker writes a twice-weekly column focusing on politics and local news for the Boston Globe Metro section. He was a member of the Globe Spotlight team that was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for local reporting in 2018 for the series Boston: Race, Image, Reality. And as mentioned, he is the host of Murder in Boston podcast, which is a Boston Globe and HBO documentary co-production over three episodes that talks about the infamous 1989 murder in Boston that still has resonance today. I hope that was good, Adrian. You can use that for your future in the LinkedIn profile. You know, speaking about this amazing documentary and series, it's so I'll set it up. I'm going to throw it to you, right? 1989, Boston, crack epidemic is raging. White flight. There's a white couple known as the Camelot couple by the media. We'll get into that. Charles Stewart and his pregnant wife, Carol, who are allegedly carjacked. They're in the quote-unquote inner city. And Charles makes a frantic call to the 911 that my pregnant wife was shot by a black man in a striped suit. And then all hell breaks loose. Take it away. Why should we care about this story from 1989 in 2024?
Yeah.
What was interesting about the story to me, I mean, I covered it when it happened. And, you know, what was interesting about the story is the aftermath of it. What you didn't mention was that the story Stewart told 911 was made up. Mm-hmm. He actually was the person who shot and killed his wife, an unborn child, and blamed it on a black man. And there was never a black man involved. And then the entire story unraveled in this very dramatic way. And so we tell it in a few different venues. There was a series in the Globe for 8 days. There's a three-part HBO documentary you referenced, and also a nine-part podcast, which I hosted, which is also called Murder in Boston.
You know, I think that what is so striking to me is that, not having known anything about the story until we were preparing for you to come on, not having remembered, and I was, you know, probably very young when it happened. Immediately for me, I'm just like, oh, he probably shot his wife. Like, not even like, not like I'm listening, you know, I'm listening to the pod, and I'm, you know, and I'm reading the articles, and it occurred to me instantly. And I'm just wondering, for you, talk to us about the racial element And this city of Boston, which I have always known from people inside of Boston, Black people and white people, to be like this hotbed of racism. I live in New York City, and yet I consider Boston to be a hotbed of racism. So talk to us about why Charles's narrative, the lie that he told, was able to take such flight instantly.
I'm going to back up for a second before I get to that and say that I think this all happened a little bit before cable television had taught all of America that the husband always did it.
Okay.
I think that automatic assumption was not quite as deeply ingrained in everybody 34, 35 years ago as it is now, thanks to Nancy Grace and others. Mm. So I think it was in a slightly different environment to begin with. But there's no question that, you know, his story sold instantly. It sold instantly to a lot of people, specifically a lot of white people, who could very easily see this idea of, you know, a Black man jumping in the car and shooting this woman. I mean, the story makes no sense if you think about it, for all kinds of reasons. But it played into things people were absolutely prepared to believe. Now, whether that's truer in Boston than it is in St. Louis is a subject, is something I might debate you on another day. But, you know, this could happen in other places. And things like this have in fact, happened in other places. But no doubt about it. I mean, it sold right away.
And, you know, I was just thinking about how it's so current, because right before we started recording, just today, there was this two news stories, nothing to do with murder. But the commentary about how when it's a Black suspect or a person of color, the story changes. And so very quickly, speaking about my Warriors, and I don't want to make you vomit in your mouth, Adrian. I know you're a Boston Celtics fan. I apologize for that. But, you know, there was a commentary today on First Take where the hosts were talking about why Draymond Green, specifically his on-court antics, right? The narrative surrounding that would be different if he were white. It was an interesting conversation. The second one is this New York Times article about Fannie Willis, the as you know, the prosecutor in the Georgia case, and specifically Black women were saying, if you're Black in this in these positions of power, you have to be perfect. You do, are not afforded the grace of a white person in this particular you know, institution. You have to be clean. You have to be just on the top of your game all the time. And then also speaking about how this has happened before, we have to look at the Exonerated Five, where, you know, the woman says it's these five Black men and the country runs with it. Donald Trump, who became president, takes out an ad, to this day refuses to apologize, even though DNA exonerated these folks. And so, you know, speaking about that racial element that was exploited, talk to us about how the media at that time, and this is pre-O.J. Simpson, right? This is pre, like you said, cable news that really sensationalized it. But nonetheless, the roots are there. And they said Black men in pinstripe suits are literally like any man, any Black man from like age of like 14 to like 65 becomes a suspect. Meanwhile, this now that we think, oh, it's totally the dude, it's totally the husband, they call them the Camelot couple. Talk to us about the media framing of 89.
Whoa. They did not call them the Camelot couple. The Boston Herald called them the Camelot couple.
Something
we're kind of insistent about over here at the Boston Globe, where we never use the term. But, you know, I'm really glad that you mentioned the Exonerated Five. And it's a great parallel because it belongs to that same era, right? That was 1988. This was 1989. It's this period where white people are freaking out about the crack epidemic. They're freaking out about, quote unquote, inner city crime and how dangerous it all is. I mean, in the case of the Central Park thing, it wasn't even the woman who said it. She was knocked out and always said she didn't know what happened to her. It was other people who, you know, led the mob against him, including, as you rightly point out, Donald Trump. So, you know, it was what the point I'm making is that it was it happened in this era where, you know, this story was really something people were prepared to believe because it tapped into so many racist preconceived notions.
What do you think, Adrian, you know, again, as we're looking at this 30 some odd years later, and what I appreciate about the documentary and the pod is that it is now looking at it through the vantage point of the absolute chaos and disruption that it caused the Black community in Boston, right? That then became a target of what I will call police terror, right? Where you're talking about, I think in one article that I read, at one point, it was 150 Black men are being stopped and frisked, you know, a week, right? And so I want to get your thoughts on why it was so important. This story had been told, why it was so important to tell it through the vantage point of the Black community after the white community had decided it was time to kind of move on.
It was important for exactly the reason you say it. It was important because this was the part of the story that had never been told properly. These were the people we had never heard from nearly enough. And, you know, as a person who has lived with this story for 30 years, I mean, the thing that always struck me, you know, is I'd be talking to somebody like Ron Bell, who ran the community center in Mission Hill in the middle of this, or his cousin Tito Jackson, who was strip searched in the middle of Tremont Street. And the way people lived with it in this visceral way, the way it never let people go, was something that was so powerful to me. And, you know, and that's not in, I mean, we did stories in Mission Hill in 1989. We didn't ignore it, but we did not do what I wish we had done. And one of the things I'm most proud of is that we went back and that those voices are really front and center in our reporting now.
You know, and what the stories that are not, if you will, highlighted, the ones that don't get the spotlight are oftentimes, as we've seen, even to this day, the ones that are marginalized, the ones that are poor, the ones that are low income, especially African-American communities. But for those who don't know about the history of Boston, specifically in race relations or racial tensions, can you take us back to 1974 and what happened in Boston with desegregation that kind of, if you will, created this climate that was rife for both brutality and exploitation?
Well, yes, I can. In 1974, a federal judge ordered the Boston Public Schools to desegregate. This was the end of a decade-plus long fight on the part of Black parents to try to win some educational equity. And the plan was for Black students to get bused into predominantly white and Irish South Boston, and for white students to get bused into Black neighborhoods like Roxbury. And the city immediately exploded, and particularly South Boston exploded. I mean, school buses with Black kids on them were rocked. There was all kinds of violence. And this violence, the racial violence that it set off then, persisted for years and years. You know, it went well into the 80s. And, you know, I've referred to it in the paper as Boston Civil War. It's a real stain on the city. And it really cemented Boston's reputation for racial intolerance. And it really is sort of the prologue to Stuart.
What I think is also really interesting, and this is something that was brought up in an article that was done on the docuseries, is that there has been several movies, right, where the focus and kind of one of the protagonists has been Boston and like this white tough guy kind of, you know, appeal. So whether it's, Matt Damon and Ben Affleck in several movies that they have done or others.
Departed.
There is this like, I don't know what you call it, white tough guy nostalgia or fairy tale that Hollywood has created around the city. What do you make of that in relationship to the reality that you just spoke of that had stamped this city in a way for racial intolerance?
Well, I mean, obviously it's really distorted because it ignores half the city, more than half of the city. Yeah, and there is this sort of romantic idea of Boston and the gangs and Whitey Bulger, who was this big gangster, and all of that. I mean, the character Jack Nicholson plays in The Departed is essentially Whitey without the Boston accent. And yeah, there's been this huge romanticism of, you know, the Irish gangs, the Italian mob, and so on. And it, you know, much to the city's detriment. And it completely ignores, you know, the experience so many Black people have had in this city. It kind of drives me crazy that's what people think of as Boston, because there's so much more of Boston.
Mm-hmm. You know, and mm-hmm. Daniel makes a good point. When I was there in Boston last year, was at a book fair, and there was a Black author who says, I grew up in the city, you know, I'm as Boston as anyone else. But when they think of Boston, they think exactly what you said. Matt Damon, Mark Wahlberg, The Departed, Irish Cops. And he says, you know, let me tell you my story. You know, I love the Celtics. I'm a Bostonian. But at the same time, I could tell you stories where I had to duck out of certain neighborhoods because I'm Black. Right. So Boston, even now, for some Black folks, has always been this way, where like we're here, we're Bostonian, we cheer for the sports. But a part of the city says you don't belong. You're not part of the narrative. And
I mean, look, when I moved here in 1989, I was told, don't go to South Boston. Don't go to Charlestown. Hyde Park is iffy. And, you know, coming from Miami, where I'd grown up, the idea that there were whole parts of the city that I wasn't supposed to set foot in was just mind-boggling to me. And it was true in Boston for a long time. I mean, you mentioned busing. There were, you know, there were a handful of Black families in places like South Boston and Charlestown when busing started. They all had to bail. And I mean, and there weren't any Black residents again for 20 years. I mean, that's part of Boston's history.
From The New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham, a keenly observed novel of a young Black man searching for his place in the world amidst a moment of historic change. Great Expectations is about David's 18 months working for the senator's presidential campaign. Along the way, David meets a myriad of people who raise a set of questions. Questions of history, art, race, religion, and fatherhood that forced David to look at his own life anew and come to terms with his identity as a young Black man and father in America. Inspired by the author's experiences working on Obama's 2008 presidential campaign, Cunningham uses a political campaign as his narrative backbone. Great Expectations will be one of the talked about novels of the year, Colm McCann. Great Expectations is available wherever books are sold.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
You know, and so it's a thing where I see, which is, sadly, we're talking about the story that took place in 1989. We're talking about the Exonerated Five again, 80s in New York. I'm old enough to remember the atrocious Willie Horton campaign that sunk Michael Dukakis's, pretty much his presidential campaign, right? Like it got the elder Bush elected. And for those of you who are youngins, go back and check it out. It was a deliberately race-baiting, terrible, like just terrible ad that preyed on white fear that there's a released Black criminal. And once he was released, he committed more crimes. And specifically, Michael Dukakis won't be tough on crime. Now, I say this in the context of the upcoming 2024 election, where if you all have been paying attention, inner city crime, migrants, right? And Tucker Carlson just said that, compared to these other cities, Moscow is the safest city. It's safer.
I mean, that's his city. So.
And so I see, Adrian, like a repeat, maybe not just a repeat, not even a remake, like a reboot. It's the reboot of the same narrative again and again. Invaders, criminals, rapists, Muslims, Black threat, inner city. And I'm sitting here thinking to myself, we have the history. We see the damage that is done to communities in Boston, in New York. Why don't we learn?
That's a great question. And I mean, it's one of the reasons really I wanted to do this story, you know, because we bury this history and we need to stop burying it. We need to come and confront it and, you know, and live with it. And you're right. I mean, you know, you do see a lot of parallels here. You do see those same notes getting struck again. You see it in the migrant debate, right? I mean, they're up in arms about migrants in places that don't even have any migrants. Mm-hmm. I mean, I watch people in New Hampshire who are like, crazed about migrants. And I'm like, what migrants? There's no migrants in Nashville, New Hampshire. Like none. Why do you care? But that whole idea of demonizing other people, I mean, it's baked into this country. It really is.
Adrian, how do you think, you know, you address the fact that during the time that this story was unfolding, that cable news was not a thing. Social media was not a thing. Now it is very much a part of our day-to-day lives. How do you think that these kinds of stories, which continue to still happen, unfortunately, how social media, does it help us in bringing a different light because people have access to places where only three news stations would give them access in, you know, in the late 80s and the 90s? Does it aid, I guess, in the kind of catch fire that took place with this story that everyone ran with it? Or like, how do you think that in today, 30 years later, these kinds of stories play out or would play out?
I think it would play out differently now because of social media. And the difference, I think the people saying, the skeptics, the people saying, I'm not sure this story makes sense. Why were they there in the first place? All that kind of stuff. They would have a place to go now, you know? They have megaphones now. They have podcasts now, for example. And I think, you know, so I think in that sense, it would play out a lot differently. At least I'd like to think so.
Yeah, but I also am thinking about, and maybe this is me being the cynic, with social media, and as we have seen the violence against Black folks, you know, that Marine who choked out that man on the subway killed him. And we see Kyle Rittenhouse, who it was at a BLM protest, but he killed and shot two white folks and is seen as the hero. I'm wondering whether or not if this murderer played his tune, if you will, to right-wing media, they would run with a Camelot couple. You know, it's very interesting. Like, I see the parallels. And I also do want to focus on this fact because I don't want to give a spoiler alert, but there was real damage. Like, they arrested the wrong guy. Can you tell us about the family that got destroyed, the community that got actually destroyed as a result of this media sensationalization?
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, I don't want to sound like a Pollyanna here. God knows we all know social media is a giant mixed bag. But to your question, you know, there were two Black men who were ultimately named publicly as suspects, Alan Swanson and later Willie Bennett. And I mean, they were dragged through the mud. They ultimately weren't charged with the crime because there was no evidence against them whatsoever. But it did a tremendous amount of damage to them and to their families and to the neighborhood around them. Absolutely.
You know, I also, you know, one of the things that are highlighted too is the mayor's actions in the beginning. Forgive me because I can't remember the name.
Ray Flynn.
Rafe. Okay. So he is being, you know, he's being told, you know, why don't you slow down a bit, right? In the way that you're like hitting the ground running, you know, just following what this man is saying, what Charles is saying, that doesn't make sense. It's not adding up. And like, if you pause for a second, and he refused, can you talk to us about like the politics of that moment? Like, you have, you know, from the president on down, talking about this war on drugs, talking about this war in the urban cities. And is it the pressure that the mayor is feeling, like, I gotta act, so it doesn't matter like whether or not I have all the facts, because I just have to act so that I don't look weak? Like, what is in your mind in throughout this investigation, what is coming into play for him?
I think that in the heat of the moment, it seemed like such a shocking crime. He felt that, you know, they had to get somebody arrested right away. They had to solve this murder right away. He holds a press conference the night of the shooting outside the hospital where Carol Stewart is being treated and says, you know, we're going to assign every single available detective in this case. And the interesting thing about that is, you know, this is a time when a lot of people are getting shot in Boston. Murders are not uncommon. And nobody was typically holding press conferences saying, we're putting everybody we got on this one, you know? So right from the beginning, it was treated as this extraordinary thing. It really fed the hysteria. And I think he had no control, which he should have had, over what the police department was doing, or didn't exercise any control. Let me put it that way. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I sought to interview Mayor Flynn, of course, for the piece, and he declined to talk about it. He's, you know, he's 84 now and has basically stopped doing interviews.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
It's one of the situations where we've talked about the power, the detriment and power of social media, of where we are now, where you have podcasts and, you know, people, especially when it comes to true crime. I mean, it is a phenomenon. You want to make money, you go into true crime, right? But we've also seen with the Innocence Project, with people unearthing evidence, you know, you've seen exoneration and accountability. You see the exonerated five. I mean, is there any, you know, recompensation for what they've lost? You know, one can't say because they lost so much, but at the same time, they're exonerated. They got some money. You know, they have an opportunity at life. What has been any form of accountability or restorative justice to those two men who were first and foremost falsely arrested, and also to the community, Adrian, that really suffered, the Black community?
Well, our current mayor, Michelle Wu, held a press conference or held an event where she publicly apologized to Alan Swanson and Willie Bennett. Swanson was there. Bennett's family was there. She apologized to the entire Black community. She said what happened here was racist and horrible and wrong. And that was important because those were things no mayor had said in the 34 years since this happened. Wow. Now, you know, immediately, and I mean, in that same event, you know, there were people saying, well, you know, the next thing that should happen is that they should get paid. I don't know if any of that's going to happen. I just don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think that acknowledgement, and I obviously that is the point of what your story reflects now, is giving the microphone and the attention to the people that were harmed, right? To the people who the story initially overlooked and were the real, you know, truly... also the victims of a heinous crime. You know, this man makes this accusation because of racism, makes this accusation. Right. Not, he could have said some young white kid, you know, ran at my car. Like he could have chosen anybody. Right. Yes. But he didn't. And then when the police pull up a man who it is not him, he could have been like, oh, I don't recognize him. That's not the guy. Instead, he said, no, that's the guy. Right. And so I just, you know, what are your, you know, last question for you, what are your hopes, you know, that people take from this documentary, from the podcast series, about, I guess, rushes to judgment and how we handle, how we think about, these types of race-based cases going forward?
I mean, my biggest hope is simply that it will make everybody slow down and think about how we think about these kinds of events. And it also will make people think about the way we try to bury this stuff. You know, there was this whole rush to move on. Let's forget about it. You know, and as Black people, we hear this all the time, you know, let's just move on and, you know, learn the lessons and go on to the next thing. But there, for the people who live this, there is no going on to the next, you know, and we need some real reconciliation, which is something we never had around the Stewart case. And if this can prompt some of that in here in Boston, I'll be happy. I'll feel like we did our work.
Can I ask a really quick follow-up? Speaking about reconciliation, some of the police officers, even after all of this, still refuse to concede that they got the wrong person, right?
Yes. Yeah, there are people in law enforcement, you know, they're retired now, but people who were in law enforcement who to this day say, I think Willie Bennett was involved somehow. But then you ask him, well, how was he involved? I mean, Willie Bennett was never connected to the crime in any way. He never met Chuck Stewart. There's nothing connecting him to this. But they say, oh, I still think he was connected somehow. And he'd say, well, what do you mean? And they can't answer the question because it's all nonsense. It's right. Utterly delusional. But to this day, they can't admit that they were wrong. That's what that's about. Right. They can't admit that they got it.
Well, Adrian, thank you so much for your work. Thank you so much for this 30-year storytelling. That is extraordinary.
I try not to do the math here.
For bringing it to light for all of us. It's incredibly important. And I hope that it does lead to some type of much needed reconciliation. But we really appreciate you joining Democracy-ish.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you for listening to Democracy-ish. I'm Danielle Moody.
I'm Mujahat Ali.
And we will be back next week if, in fact, we have a country left. Inshallah.